White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Well, hello again, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second installment of the International Jew Study Hour, Henry Ford's great classic. On this July 5th, 2012, I am Carolyn Yeager, and my co-host is Hadding Scott. He's here, and he will speak in a moment. First, I want to say that you can send in your questions tonight during the program to Carolyn at CarolynYeager.com. And I'll read them on the air. Try to keep them short and to the point. Now, we ended last week still in Chapter 1, and we will probably not get any further than finishing Chapter 1 today. I was a little ambitious thinking that we would move through it that fast, because Chapter 1 is a very long chapter, and we still have a long way to go in it. We did maybe about one-third last week, and we've got two-thirds still, and it's pretty important. We were reading about usury and the law of the stranger, and I think, Hadding, aren't you going to give a little recap of what we covered last week?
Yeah, I can do that. Let's see. Summary of what we've read so far from Chapter 1 of The International Jew. In the aftermath of World War I, the Jew had risen to a new prominence in financial, political, and social spheres. The Jew, as of 1920, was coming under unprecedented scrutiny, not unintelligent persecution, but scrutiny, in regard to the charge of being the source of Bolshevism, which Ford considers likely, given that so many Jews are leftists in the United States, in regard to the charge of responsibility for the collapse of the German Reich after World War One, at the end of World War One, because in England they are accused as the hidden financial power that is able to coerce governments, and because of the observation of how Jews exploited the war bureaucracy in the United States for personal gain. And he says, we should resist the tendency to avoid discussing this matter just because it lends itself to prejudice. To avoid discussing this matter just because it lends itself to prejudice. In other words, the really nice people might not want to talk about this, but we really need to talk about this because sooner or later, this problem is going to have to be faced. Jews as a people, he says, strongly prefer commerce over productive occupations. In 1920, most big businesses, most trusts and banks, most natural resources, and the chief agricultural products, especially sugar, tobacco, and cotton, were, quote, in the control of Jewish financiers or their agents, close quote. Jews own many department stores, often operated under non-Jewish names. Many Jews are big landlords. Jews have a big presence in journalism and dominate the theatrical world. They absolutely control circulation of publications in the United States. This is back in 1920. The Jews use their control of mass media to give constant positive publicity to Jews. Ford asks, if the Jew is in control, how did it happen? Jewish solidarity and the fact that Jewish entrepreneurs arriving in America got financial backing from Jews still in Europe made it much easier for Jews than for other European immigrants to rise to prominence in the United States. Jews did not win their power based on individual competition, but based on the extension of Jewish financial power across the sea. Jews have one morality for dealing with fellow Jews, but the law of the stranger for dealing with non-Jews. And they have to live among non-Jews in order to profit from usury and so forth, which Old Testament law would forbid them from doing to each other.
Okay, and so that's where we ended up talking about the law of the stranger and right. reading that sentence, the Jew has had the opportunity, I keep moving around here. The Jew has had the opportunity to practice the ethics of the stranger for many centuries. So now we continue with chapter one, which is the Jew in character and business. And would you read, Daddy?
Okay. Being dispersed among the nations, but never merging themselves with the nations.
And no, it's never... being strangers.
No, I got it. I got it. This is the beginning of that paragraph.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Being dispersed among the nations, but never merging themselves with the nations, and never losing a very distinctive identity, the Jew has had the opportunity to practice, quote, the ethics of the stranger, closed quote, for many centuries. Being strangers among strangers, and often cruelly hostile strangers, they have found this law a compensating advantage. Still, this alone would not account for the Jews' preeminence in finance. The explanation of that must be sought in the Jew himself, his vigor, resourcefulness, and special proclivities.
See, now here this kind of shows where Ford, well, this isn't Ford actually writing this, but Ford's influence maybe in having a certain amount of admiration for the Jew.
He's trying to be fair.
He's trying, yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Now, you find in a lot of places here that they're trying real, real hard to be fair. And then, but then though, they come with the right final verdict anyway, you know. So that is probably the fair verdict. Okay. I just wanted to point that out.
Very early in the Jewish story, we discover the tendency of Israel to be a master nation with other nations as its vassals. Notwithstanding the fact that the whole prophetic purpose with reference to Israel seems to have been the moral enlightenment of the world through its agency, Israel's will to mastery apparently hindered that purpose. At least such would seem to be the tone of the Old Testament. Divinely ordered to drive out the Canaanites that their corrupt ideas might not contaminate Israel, the Jews did not obey, according to the old record. They looked over the Canaanitish people and perceived what great amount of manpower would be wasted if they were expelled. And so Israel enslaved them. Quote, and it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. It was this form of obedience, this preference of material mastery. This preference of material mastery over spiritual leadership that marked the beginning of Israel's age-long disciplinary distress. I want to point out something in that paragraph. Back in the first sentence, he uses the term master nation. Have you ever seen that in English before? Master nation.
Well, you mean for anybody or for the Jews?
For anybody.
Master yeah, the Germans. Well, the Germans were supposed to be the...
Right, and the word that they would translate as master nation would be Herrenvolk.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, except unless you're translating Herrenvolk, you're not going to write something like master nation. So I'm saying that this looks to me like a passage that may have been translated from a German original.
Oh, because, they like to call the Germans... the National Socialist Germans as wanting to be the, thinking they were the master race.
Master race, yeah.
Same thing.
They really didn't use that term. This term Herrenvolk actually has a long history. They used it back in reference to the French in the early 19th century
mm-hmm.
when Napoleon and France were dominating Europe. France at that time was called a Herrenvolk. So... It's really not specifically associated with National Socialism at all. But when I see this master nation here in English, it tells me somebody's been reading some German.
Okay, probably. Yeah. Not surprising.
All right.
And then this whole history here, which it doesn't go on very long, but this whole history of the ancient Jews, that's the general, Christian Old Testament idea that the Jews were these people. I don't really accept that anymore without question. Anyway, I don't know for sure, but I don't just take it as fact. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, archaeology shows that there was no Jewish settlement at the site of Jerusalem prior to the 6th century BC. All that stuff with David and Solomon was supposed to be 400 years earlier. So
yeah.
It cannot possibly have happened, at least not anywhere near Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Some people think that Solomon was really an Arabian king, and the Jews just took the story and called it their own.
Okay.
Let's see. The Jews' dispersion among the nations temporarily, that is, for more than 25 centuries now, changed the program which their scriptures declare was divinely planned. And that dispersion continues until today. There are spiritual leaders in modern Judaism who still claim that Israel's mission to the nations is spiritual, but their assertions that Israel today is fulfilling that mission are not as convincing as they might be if accompanied by more evidence. Israel, throughout the modern centuries, is still looking at the Gentile world and estimating what its manpower can be made to yield. But the discipline upon Israel still holds. He is in exile from his own land, condemned to be discriminated against wherever he goes until the time when exile and homelessness shall end in a reestablished Palestine, and Jerusalem again become the moral center of the earth, even as the elder prophets have declared. I think probably some of these Jews do imagine that they're ministering unto the Spirit by teaching us all kinds of multicultural garbage.
They think
they're doing
good. I'm sure they're convinced that they are. They do believe they're the light of the world. And some of them can be a little critical of what, say, the Israel is doing, because it doesn't look like they're ministering. So they're a little critical, but not too much.
Had the Jew become an employee, a worker for other men, his dispersion would not probably have been so wide. But becoming a trader, his instincts drew him around the habitable earth. There were Jews in China at an early date. They appeared as traders in England at about the same at the time of the Saxons. Jewish traders were in South America 100 years before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth Rock. Jews established the sugar industry in the island of St. Thomas in 1492. They were well established in Brazil when only a few villages dotted the eastern coast of what is now the United States. And how far they penetrated when once they came here is indicated by the fact that the first white child born in Georgia was a Jew, Isaac Minnis. The Jew's presence around the earth, his clannishness with his own people, made him a nation scattered among the nations, a corporation with agents everywhere.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know, I was just amazed at that. The first white child born in Georgia was a Jew.
So-called white.
So-called white. Yeah, right, exactly. Glad you added that. But, you know, I thought, boy, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have expected that. But there you go. As they say, they're everywhere.
Well, who knows? They may have been, trading or something.
Yes, and I don't know. They don't give a year, so I don't know when that was. It might not be.
I'm sure it's on Wikipedia somewhere.
Yeah.
Another talent, however, contributed greatly to his rise in financial power, his ability to invent new devices for doing business. Until the Jew was pitted against the world, business was very crudely done. And when we trace the origins of many of the business methods which simplify and facilitate trade today, more likely than not, we find a Jewish name at the end of the clue. Many of the indispensable instruments of credit and exchange were thought out by Jewish merchants, not only for use between themselves, but to check and hold Gentiles with whom they dealt. The oldest bill of exchange extant was drawn by a Jew, one Simon Rubens. The promissory note was a Jewish invention, as was also the check payable to bearer.
The promissory note is an IOU, right? I mean, basically.
I think so.
Yeah. So you say, I promise to pay you this. So they were, they could keep all their gold in their own vaults, I guess, so that they were holding for people, and just have them using pieces of paper to represent what they were doing. And it was pretty clever of them. Must say, it's amazing. They're the ones who came up with all of this, according to Ford's investigators.
And it also opens up a world of possibilities for corruption too when you start using paper instead
of
actual objects. It seems to me all fractional reserve banking is a swindle.
Yes,
because
it is.
You've got 1 ounce of gold, so you're gonna use that as a basis for lending out a piece of paper that says this is good for 1 ounce of gold. But you're going to write 10 of those pieces of paper so that there's no way that all 10 of those people can get their 1 ounce of gold if they all decide to ask for it. It's a swindle.
Yes.
But that's how banks, I mean, as long as the money was still redeemable for metals, that's how they operated.
And then if there is a run on the bank, then they start switching among banks and so on, and the government jumps in, and well, they just, you know, bail people out, so they can just keep going with this system. Yeah. Anyway, okay. There's a lot more to talk about as we go on.
An interesting bit of history attaches to the payable to bearer instrument. The Jews' enemies were always stripping them of their last ounce of wealth. Yet strangely, the Jews recovered very quickly and were soon rich again. How this sudden recovery from looting and poverty? Their assets were concealed under bearer, and so a goodly portion was always saved. In an age when it was lawful for any pirate to seize goods consigned to Jews, the Jews were able to protect themselves by consigning goods on policies that bore no names.
Yeah.
The influence of the Jew was to center business around goods instead of persons. Previously, all claims had been against persons. The Jew knew that the goods were more reliable than the persons with whom he dealt, and so he contrived to have claims laid against goods. Besides, this device enabled him to keep himself out of sight as much as possible. This introduced an element of hardness into his business, inasmuch as it was goods which were being dealt in rather than men being dealt with, and this hardness remains. Another tendency which survives and which is of advantage in veiling the very large control which Jews have attained is of the same origin as bearer bills. It permits a business dominated by Jewish capital to appear under a name that gives no hint of Jewish control.
Well, we were speaking about that a little bit earlier. Or were we speaking about that before we came on the air? I don't remember now. This is a big part of how they have developed business so that they can hide. They've developed everything so that they can hide without and behind fronts of Gentile names and it not be clear who's really running it, who's really controlling it.
Yeah, he mentions that they had a lot of department stores that had non-Jewish names on the sign. Mm-hmm. And, there's this big conspiracy theory that says that, some of the big, non-Jewish American bankers, really owed everything to Rothschild. You know, like J.P. Morgan supposedly really didn't have much money, but was effectively an agent for Rothschild. I don't know if that's true or not. Eustace Mullins used to push that theory.
Yeah, well, the trouble is Eustace Mullins said a lot of things that are being used badly for wild conspiracy theories and so on. So I don't know if he was a little irresponsible or what, but he became so revered that you can hardly criticize him. I never read any of his books.
I I actually did read one or two things by him a long time ago when I was just starting to get into things. But I think his material, I think his standards for sources that he used was not the highest. A lot of the stuff that he was putting out was just...
Sometimes he'd guess at it or just say it because it fit with everything else.
Well, there was, for example, there's a... there was something that was put in the congressional record about racial program for the 20th century by some communist Jew named Cohen. And nobody can find the original of that anywhere. Eustace Mullins supposedly saw it, read it somewhere, but he can't say exactly where. So I mean, that's effectively useless and even worse than useless because people can say, this is not a real source. You yeah. don't really have this source saying this. You're lying. Made it yeah. up. Well, you right. got me there. I don't know what the source is for that. It's Eustace Mullins. He made it up. Okay. The Jew is the only and original international capitalist. Oh, that's an interesting statement. The Jew mm-hmm. is the only and original international capitalist. How about those Bush people? All those people doing trade with China. Bunch of pseudo Jews, I guess, or maybe
hidden. Well, he's the original one.
Yeah, the only and original. They were the only ones at that time, I guess.
Yeah. Well.
Now they got a lot of imitators. But as a rule, he prefers not to emblazon that fact upon the skies. He prefers to use Gentile banks and trust companies as his agents and instruments. The suggestive term "Gentile front" often appears in connection with this practice.
Well, maybe that's where the Bush people come in, and all these people you just mentioned. What about all those non-Jewish people? Well, maybe they're agents and fronts for the big Jewish money.
Yes, and some of these Gentile fronts might really not be Gentiles, too. Peter Schenck yeah. used to say that Bush is a Jewish name, and there definitely are some Jews named Bush, like the... One of the first Freemasons to come to North America was named Solomon Bush.
You know, I think there's just... I know. I read about him. I think there's just about every name that some Jew has. You know, I mean, you can hardly... there's probably a few, but they've just gone and grabbed up every Gentile name and applied it to themselves somewhere along the line. That's one of my pet peeves. That they take our names.
Supposedly some Jew named Hitler.
That was Poland. There were now the they've discovered and they act like there's a whole bunch of them, and there wasn't a whole bunch of them, but there was obviously some. I even found once, you know, the name Jaeger, which I thought, well, that is not there. No Jews have that name, but probably, spelled J A G E R, you know, with the umlaut over the A. I came across something somewhere. Where it was a Jew, I thought, oh, it made me so mad. Boy, it made me mad. Why don't have any right to that name? They don't have any right to a lot of the names they have. But anyway,
it
sounds
some names,
very anti-Semitic, doesn't it?
There's some names that are much more common with Jews than with other people, though.
Yes, you know, yes. That's
like Horowitz. I don't think you'd ever find a non-Jew named Horowitz.
No, that's right.
Or Cohen.
And we don't go around stealing their names. You know, we don't want them, but they take our names. Well, okay.
Okay, the invention of the stock exchange is also credited to Jewish financial talent. In Berlin, Paris, London, Frankfurt, and Hamburg, Jews were in control of the first stock exchanges, while Venice and Genoa were openly referred to in the talk of the day as Jewish cities, or Jew cities, it says, where great trading and banking facilities might be found. The Bank of England was established upon the counsel and assistance of Jewish emigrants from Holland. The Bank of Amsterdam and the Bank of Hamburg both arose through Jewish influence. There is a curious fact to be noted in connection with the persecution and consequent wanderings of the Jews about Europe, and that is, wherever they wandered, the center of business seemed to go with them. When the Jews were free in Spain, there was the world's gold center. When Spain drove out the Jews, Spain lost financial leadership and has never regained it. Students of the economic history of Europe have always been puzzled to discover why the center of trade should have shifted from Spain, Portugal, and Italy up to the northern countries of Holland, Germany, and England. They have sought for the cause in many things, but none has proved completely explanatory. When, however, it is known that the change was coincident with the expulsion of the Jews from the south and their flight to the north, when it is known that upon the Jews' arrival, the northern countries began a commercial life which has flourished until our day, the explanation does not seem difficult. Time and again, it has proved to be the fact that when the Jews were forced to move, the center of the world's precious metals moved with them.
Mm-hmm.
This distribution of the Jews over Europe and the world, each Jewish community linked in a fellowship of blood, faith, and suffering with every other group, made it possible for the Jew to be international in the sense that no other race or group of merchants could be at that time. Not only were they everywhere, Americans and Russians are also everywhere, but they were in touch. They were organized before the days of conscious international commercial organizations. They were bound together by the sinews of a common life. It was observed by many writers in the Middle Ages that the Jews knew more of what was transpiring in Europe than the governments did. They also had better knowledge of what was likely to occur. They knew more about conditions than the statesmen did. This information they imparted by letter from group to group, country to country. Indeed, they may be said thus to have originated unconsciously the financial newsletter.
I like that. I think that's funny. They started the financial newsletter too with their info newsletters that they sent around to each other.
Certainly the information they were able to obtain and thus distribute was invaluable to them in their speculative enterprises. Advanced knowledge was an immense advantage in days when news was scarce, slow, and unreliable. This enabled Jewish financiers to become the agents of national loans, a form of business which they encouraged wherever possible. The Jew has always desired to have nations for his customers. National loans were facilitated by the presence of members of the same family of financiers in various countries, thus making an interlocking directorate by which king could be played against king, government against government, and the shrewdest use made of national prejudices and fears, all to the no small profit of the fiscal agent. One of the charges most commonly made against Jewish financiers today is that they still favor this larger field of finance. Indeed, in all the criticism that is heard regarding the Jew as a businessman, there is relatively little said against him as an individual merchant serving individual customers. Thousands of small Jewish merchants are highly respected by their trade, just as tens of thousands of Jewish families are respected as our neighbors. The criticism, insofar as it respects the more important financiers, is not racial at all. Unfortunately, the element of race, which so easily lends itself to misinterpretation as racial prejudice, is injected into the question by the mere fact that the chain of international finance, as it is traced around the world, discloses at every link a Jewish capitalist, financial family, or a Jewish-controlled banking system.
Now, this, I think, is really, really an important little part here. And I wrote my comment that this shows that Jews are responsible for the racial prejudice they complain about. You know, and that's what he's saying here. You know, it's not that people are prejudiced against Jews to begin with. It's that everywhere you look, where money is concerned, it's the Jews running it, and their interlocking families and so on. So this makes people suspicious, and also, you know, Gentiles don't like that. Why would we?
Well, you know, that's the whole theme of the ADL is that anti-Semitism is not caused by anything that Jews do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just caused by hateful non-Jews.
Well, when you look at the history here, you see what they've been doing, and this is what's good about about this book, because it goes into detail, and it will continue to go into so much detail about their history and what they've been doing. So continue. We still have a long way to go to the end.
Many have professed to see in this circumstance a conscious organization of Jewish power for Gentile control, while others have attributed the circumstance to Jewish racial sympathies, to the continuity of their family affairs down the line of descent, and to the increase of collateral branches. In the old scriptural phrase, Israel grows as the vine grows, ever shooting out new branches and deepening old roots, but always part of the one vine. The Jew's aptitude for dealing with governments may also be traced to the years of his persecution. He early learned the power of gold in dealing with mercenary enemies. Wherever he went, there followed him like a curse the aroused antipathy of other peoples. The Jew was never popular as a race. Even the most fervid Jew will not deny that, howsoever he may explain it. Individuals have been popular, of course. Many phases of Jewish nature are found to be very lovable when known. But nevertheless, one of the burdens the Jews have had to bear as a race is this burden of racial unpopularity. Even in modern times, in civilized countries, in conditions which render persecution absolutely impossible, this unpopularity exists. And what is more, the Jew has not seemed to care to cultivate the friendship of the Gentile masses, due perhaps to the failures of experience, but due more likely to his inborn persuasion that he belongs to a superior race. Whatever the true reason, he has always placed his main dependence on cultivating friendship with kings and nobles. What cared the Jew if the people gnashed their teeth against him, so long as the king and the court were his friends? Thus there was always, even through most of the severely trying times, a court Jew, one who had bought by loans and held by the stranglehold of debt an entrance to the king's chamber. The policy of the Jews has always been to go to headquarters. They never tried to placate the Russian people, but they did endeavor to enlist the Russian court. They never tried to placate the German people, but they did succeed in permeating the German court. In England, they shrugged their shoulders at the outspoken anti-Jew reactions of the British populace. What care they? Have they not all of lorddom at their heels? Do they not hold the strings of Britain's purse? Through this ability of theirs to go to headquarters, it is possible to account for the stronghold they got upon various governments and nations. Added to this ability, of course, was the ability to produce what the governments wanted. If a government wanted a loan, the Jew at court could arrange it through Jews at other financial centers and political capitals. If one government wanted to pay another government a debt without risking the precious metal to a mule train through a robber-infested country, the Jew at court arranged that too. He transferred a piece of paper, and the debt was paid by the banking house at the foreign capital. The first time an army was ever fed in the modern commissary way, it was done by a Jew. He had the capital and he had the system. Moreover, he had the delight of having a nation for his customer. And this tendency...
Yeah, well, this is... I've got a little note here. What this is telling us is that we have not been alert. We have not been observant. We have not been defensive enough, but I think we have trusted in our majority to allow the Jews to do these jobs and to do this work, not realizing what kind of power they were amassing as they were doing it. You know, and I think this trusting in ourselves as a majority, white people and European people in our own homelands, not imagining that could change as quickly as it has been able to change in the last century. You know, I mean, we saw it there. They were doing it, but we weren't worrying about it, were we? So go ahead.
And this tendency, which served the race so well through the through the troublous centuries, shows no sign of abatement. Certainly, seeing to what an extent a race numerically so unimportant influences the various governments of the world today, the Jew who reflects upon the disparity between his people's numbers and their power may be pardoned if he sees in that fact a proof of their racial superiority. And they've got us thinking that way, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the way Republicans think. If you can make a lot of money, you're a good person.
No, that's true. Yep.
It may be said also that Jewish inventiveness in business devices continues to the present time, as well as Jewish adaptability to changing conditions. The Jew is credited with being the first to establish branch houses in foreign countries in order that responsible representatives of the home office might be on the ground taking instant advantage of every opening. During the war, a great deal was said about the peaceful penetration which the German government had effected in the United States by establishing here branch offices and factories of German firms. The fact that there were many German branch houses here is unquestionable. It should be known, however, that they were not the evidence of German enterprise, but of Jewish enterprise. The old German business houses were too conservative to run after customers, even in the hustling United States. But the Jewish firms were not. And they came straight to America and hustled. In due time, the competition forced the more conservative German firms to follow suit. But the idea was Jewish in its origin, not German. Another modern business method whose origin is credited to Jewish financiers is that by which related industries are bought together, as, for example, if an electrical power company is acquired, then the street railway company using the electricity would be acquired too, one purpose being in this way to conserve all the profit accruing along the line, from the origination of the power down to the delivery of the streetcar ride. But perhaps the main purpose being that by the control of the powerhouse, the price of current could be increased to the car company, and by the control of the car company, the cost of a ride could be increased to the public, the controllers thus receiving an additional profit all down the line. There's much of this going on in the world today, and in the United States particularly. The portion of the business immediately next to the ultimate consumer explains that its costs have risen, but it does not explain that the costs were increased by the owners and not by outsiders who were forced to do so by economic pressure.
Ah, that's really good. You know, this is just the way it works. I mean, it still works this way. You know, they tell you the reasons why they have to do things, but they're not the reasons. They're not the real reasons. It's because they're in control and they can do what they want.
I'm sorry, it's beyond my control. There is apparently in the world today a central financial force which is playing a vast and closely organized game with the world for its table and universal control for its stakes. The people of civilized countries have lost all confidence in the explanation that economic conditions are responsible for all the changes that occur. Under the camouflage of economic law, a great many phenomena have been accounted for which were not due to any law whatever, except the law of the selfish human will, as operated by a few men who have the purpose and the power to work on a wide scale with nations as their vassals. Whatever else may be national, no one today believes that finance is national. Finance is international. Nobody today believes that international finance is in any way competitive. There are some independent banking houses, but few strong independent ones. The great masters, the few whose minds see clearly the entire play of the plan, control numerous banking houses and trust companies, and one is used for this while another is used for that, but there is no disharmony between them, no correction of each other's methods, no competition in the interests of the business world. There is as much unity of policy. There is as much unity of policy between the principal banking houses of every country as there is between the various branches of the United States Post Office. And for the same reason, namely, they are all operated from the same source and for the same purpose.
Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, what a comparison between the principal banking houses and between the various branches of the United States Post Office. Well, back then, when it really was the United States Post Office, I mean, what would the branches be? Just a part of the same company. So it's like that kind of plays into the whole idea that there was one banking system run by the Rothschilds and everybody else is a little bit inferior to them.
Or they're at least all reading from the same playbook anyway.
Yeah, right, yes.
Just before the war, Germany bought very heavily in American cotton and had huge quantities of it tied up here for export. When war came, the ownership of that mountainous mass of cotton wealth changed in one night from Jewish names in Hamburg to Jewish names in London. At this writing, cotton is selling in England for less than it is selling in the United States, and the effect of that is to lower the American price. When the price lowers sufficiently, the market is cleared of cotton by buyers previously prepared, and then the price soars to high figures again. In the meantime, the same powers that have engineered the apparently causeless strengthening and weakening of the cotton market have seized upon stricken Germany to be the sweatshop of the world. Talking about market manipulation and inside trading there.
Mm-hmm.
Certain groups control the cotton, lend it to Germany to be manufactured, leave a pittance of it there in payment for the labor that was used, and then profiteer the length and breadth of the world on the lie that cotton is scarce. And when, tracing all these antisocial and colossally unfair methods to their source, it is found that the responsible parties all have a common characteristic, is it any wonder that the warning which comes across the sea, "Wait until America becomes awake to the Jew," has a new meaning?
Hey, so then that was what people were saying at that time. The Europeans were saying, "Wait until America becomes awake to the Jew."
I don't know if
the Europeans ever became awake enough. Yeah, I do too. But somebody, I mean, they got that from somewhere in 1920.
Yeah, I wonder who that was. Certainly, economic reasons no longer explain the condition in which the world finds itself today. Neither does the ordinary explanation of the heartlessness of capital. This is pretty important here.
Yes.
Capital has endeavored, as never before, to meet the demands of labor. And labor has gone to extremes in leading capital to new concessions. But what has it advantaged either of them? Labor has heretofore thought that capital, he means the industrial capitalist, was the sky over it, and it made the sky yield. But behold, there was yet an higher sky, which neither capital nor labor had seen in their struggles with one another. That sky is so far unyielding.
Mm.
That which we call capital here in America is usually money used in production. And we mistakenly refer to the manufacturer, the manager of work, the provider of tools and jobs, we refer to him as the capitalist. Oh no, he is not the capitalist in the real sense. Why, he himself must go to capitalists for the money with which to finance his plans. There is a power yet above him, a power which treats him far more callously and holds him in a far more ruthless hand than he would ever dare to display to his labor. That, indeed, is one of the tragedies of these times, that labor and capital are fighting each other. When the conditions against which each one of them protests, and from which each one of them suffers, is not within their power to remedy at all, unless they find a way to wrest world control from that group of international financiers who create and control both these conditions.
Well, that's amazing. That's so very good. And, you know, we talk so much today about Republicans and Democrats. And, of course, in an election year, it becomes more acute. and that were supposedly fighting each other, but we know that they're not really. And here it's saying that even labor and capital are not really fighting each other. That it's this is real
conspiracy
stuff. Well,
that's not his point there.
Okay, what is it?
His point is that the industrialist and the workers are not enemies. They're both suffering from the moneylender.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's a little more subtle.
The finance capitalist is the real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like that very much because I just cannot be totally against capitalism or anything to do with capital because capitalism, if it's not over, if it's not misused, is a real good form of new ventures and entrepreneurism and so on, and moves things forward. So don't you think?
Well, capitalism in the proper sense of the word means economic growth. It involves economic growth fueled by money lending.
Mm-hmm.
The finance capitalist is. This is what he's saying there. He's saying the finance capitalist, the money lender, is the real capitalist. The industrial capitalist owes this money to the finance capitalist. He has to work his labor hard to keep up with interest on debts.
Okay.
And it was Karl Marx that put all the focus on the industrial capitalist. And basically, he pretended that the finance capitalist didn't even exist.
Oh, there you go. Huh. All right. Well, let's keep
going
here.
That's the whole theme of Gottfried Feder's manifesto, is that everybody could have a much easier life if we just canceled the interest on debts.
Yes.
Let people pay off their debts. And then.
So super capitalists, finance capitalists who have created the system that way and they're keeping it going. Aren't they? We can't. They don't allow us to get out of it in one way or another. And they're the ones that start the wars. You know, ordinary capitalists don't want war.
Yeah, I don't even like to use the word capitalist to refer to
industrialist.
A factory owner.
Yeah, industrialist.
I would call an industrialist.
Even oil companies. Oil companies don't want war. That doesn't benefit them. It's only these finance capitalists, all right? That's a good way to put it. They're the ones who want it.
All right.
They're the ones who benefit. Okay.
There is a super capitalism which is supported wholly by the fiction that gold is wealth. There is a super government which is allied to no government, which is free from them all, and yet which has its hand in them all. There is a race, a part of humanity, which has never yet been received as a welcome part, and which has succeeded in raising itself to a power that the proudest Gentile race has never claimed, not even Rome in the days of her proudest power. It is becoming more and more the conviction of men all over the world that the labor question, the wage question, the land question cannot be settled until, first of all, this matter of an international super-capitalistic government is settled. Hang on a second, I got to take care of something. Go ahead and read.
Okay, I will finish it up. To the victor belongs the spoils, in quotes, is an old saying. And in a sense, it is true that if all this power of control has been gained and held by a few men of a long despised race, then either they are supermen whom it is powerless to resist, or they are ordinary men whom the rest of the world has permitted to obtain an undue and unsafe degree of power. Unless the Jews are supermen, the Gentiles will have themselves to blame for what has transpired, and they can look for a rectification in a new scrutiny of the situation and a candid examination of the experiences of other countries. And that is the end of chapter one. I say this is what is being debated now when we're talking about who is responsible or what has befallen us as white people and our countries and our demographics and so on. Who is responsible for that? Are we responsible, or is somebody else responsible? Who is well, what would you call that, Hadding, who is interjecting things of a very sneaky, sneaky nature, which we have not been able, we have not really recognized and done anything about soon enough. So he says, you know, either these people are supermen and we can't resist them, so we might as well quit, or they're ordinary men and we've permitted them to obtain this undue and unsafe degree of power. I think it's the latter. And so we have to take some blame for that. But I really think that that they have gone about it in such a way that at every step and every stage, we find ourselves unable to recognize or to do anything. And, of course, they've always used this prejudice, anti-Semitism thing, which became more and more effective, is very effective now. And so this is really setting the scene, I think, this first chapter for what the reason and the purpose of the rest of all of it. And you know, when he started out, he didn't intend to write as much as he did. He intended probably the first 20 chapters, and then he went on and ended up with 80 chapters. So it just kept growing. But this is good that we can discuss this a little bit if you want. We've got about 8 minutes, or we can also go into the Freemason thing. What would you prefer to do? Your crunchy.
Well, I want to. Ford, in the part that we read last week, he asked, "What is it that has allowed the Jew to take over?" And he says, "Well, they've got help because they stick together, and the rich Jews over in Europe are financing the ones over here so that they could build up big enterprises and beat everybody in business." And also they all work together, so they basically had monopolies. They took over the film industry. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it completely legally. They were using film stock that was patented that they was illegal for them to use. You know why they started their film empire out in California, right?
I have read that, but I can't think of it right now.
It's because they were violating patents with their movie making. And Edison owned the patents. And Edison lived in New Jersey, and he had men that he would send out to smash their equipment. So they moved as far away as possible from Edison. So it would be too inconvenient for him to send people all the way out to California to smash their Jewish show.
So they stole all that from the great Edison, who was a friend of Henry Ford's.
Yes,
he was. Is that true? Ford was a friend of all those great inventors and people of his time. That was a great time. But the Jews were in there right then, mulling their way around and stealing and doing their damage. Well, it was only Ford who did a project like this. It wasn't Edison. Did Edison ever speak out against what the Jews were doing?
Edison if I recall correctly, Edison would not hire Jews.
Okay. He went that far anyway.
Yeah, he would not hire a Jew. Interesting thing, I remember hearing this anecdote some years ago that Henry Ford had Thomas Edison's dying breath in a bottle.
Oh, did... You know, yeah. I can believe that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he admired him very much, didn't he?
Yeah. Since this guy wrote to us about Freemasonry and raising a big stink about the fact that Henry Ford was a Freemason, we got 5 minutes or so left.
Okay.
You can see certain indications. Well, first let me say Freemasonry is really... Anglo-American Freemasonry has been mainstream in American life. George Washington was a Freemason. I'm not saying this really as an apologist for Freemasonry, but just to point out that it's not a fringe movement. And
you know, just to put this in perspective, because like this emailer and many people, they just freak out at the word Freemason. And while it's not good, they don't look at any finer points about the person. They just accuse if somebody was a Freemason, well, you know, pretty soon it's everybody. So that's when they say they're all rotten. They're all in the same club. There's nobody to look up to. And this yeah. seems to me to work out, you know, in our enemy's hands when we have to hate all of our people.
Yeah. Well, I know a couple of I've been acquainted with a couple of Freemasons online that were racialists. Mona Montgomery is a Freemason.
Oh, now that explains some things I've heard her say. Yeah, she called in once in my when I had my RBN program and said, no, the Freemasons were the good people. And I didn't quite know what to make of that. But
See, there's a big difference between Anglo-American and European continental Freemasonry. The European continental Freemasons are the ones that do the really radical, crazy revolutions. Anglo-American Freemasons did the American Revolution. And it used to be, at least in the South, that everybody who was anybody was a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
Many people in the Ku Klux Klan were Masons. The revival Ku Klux Klan in 1915 was recruited mostly from Masonic lodges, although they did it in spite of Freemasonry itself. Freemasonry was not in favor of the Ku Klux Klan. Masonic doctrine is not hospitable to racism. It is an Enlightenment worldview, believes in trying to make reason prevail in the world and judging people as individuals and being a world citizen, more or less, this kind of outlook on the world. And you can see some of this reflected in Ford's attitude toward the Jews. He really wants to be fair to them. He doesn't want to indulge in religious bigotry. That's like one of the main bugbears for Freemasonry.
Okay.
And, they actually tend, through the progress of the degrees, they try to wean people off of Christianity.
Well, they must not have succeeded with Ford. And let me just throw in
hard
here.
Hard to tell.
He was what they say raised, you know. I don't know if that's your very first thing in Freemasonry or when you reach certain degrees, but he was raised in November 28th, 1894. This was really early in his career. You know, he was born in like 1860 something, wasn't it? I mean, when he died, he was pretty old. So, okay, well, we got one. So anyway, I'm just saying that, you know, I don't think he remained so active in it later on when he started recognizing and being against the Jews.
Well, see, the thing is, Freemasonry is like Stoicism in that it encourages its people to respect whatever the native religion happens to be. You don't try to wean everybody else away from their religion, but you yourself get weaned away from it. You try to become a more rational person.
Mm-hmm.
That's at least their doctrine. Anyway, to a large extent, it's left up to each Freemason to make for himself of it whatever he will. So, you know, Henry Ford went in this particular direction trying to make reason prevail on the Jewish question that he perceived.
Very good. Very good, Hattie. I want to thank you again, Hattie, and I want to tell the listeners that we're about finished here. And we're going to have our closing music. So thank you for listening to us live. We didn't have any email questions tonight. We will be back next week for Chapter 2. So come see us then.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.